Yo, Mike, welcome back. It's been a minute. How are you?
Hello, hello. Good.
All right. The people demanded more Mike.
Oh, did they?
Yeah, no.
Oh.
Yeah, yes, they always do. They're like whatever it takes to keep me from talking to AI like a crazy person.
Okay, yeah. Yeah.
By the way, the last pod, I'm sure most people skipped it, but I gave because it was just me talking to an AI like an insane person. But I did give you a shout out for something you said a while ago that was pretty interesting.
What was that?
It was in the, you know, like we have that stonk channel in the Discord where we talk about investments and such.
Stonks and biz, yes.
Stonks and biz. I don't know if you remember this, but like there was, you know, people were like talking a big game about this or that.
By the way, before you get too far into this, I don't see any, activity on the audio lines on the thing. Do you see?
Yeah, no, we're fine. I see it.
Okay.
Yep.
Anyways.
Sorry. So yeah, so we were talking about this, you know, this crypto or that stonk or whatever. And there was a lot of conviction going on about, you know, whether this thing was going to 10x or, you know, how people are. And you had said, look, it doesn't fucking matter what you say or what your reasoning is until you actually put some fucking chips down. Like, if you don't invest in your grand thesis, then you don't even, what does it matter? Even if you're right, you know, I think that's a very important point, which is like talking about shit you're going to do with your money or your freedom or your time is not the same as actually doing the damn thing.
So when I talk to people and we get to talking about investments or whatever, I mean, at some point in the conversation, I'm going to be asking them like, okay, so what do you have invested? What are you actually doing here?
Yeah.
Cause I don't want to hear your opinion. I want to hear your investment. Thesis,
what do you do rather than what?
Like, what are you actually doing? So it's, coming from a small business background, when I'm talking to somebody on the phone and I'm trying to sell them something or they're trying to sell me something, I know exactly where all of that money is going or has been placed. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So when I'm just like at the bar or whatever, yeah, I mean, obviously I'm not an asshole. I'm not, you know, I'm not going to shut anyone out, but at the same time, it's like, okay, what's your, like, what are you actually invested in? You know?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. I mean, and I don't know. I feel like people talk a lot without actually jumping into their grand thesis, you know, or they're putting like very small amounts down and, I'm not saying that to like, you know, condescend or whatever. I'm just saying like I am interested in what people are actually doing, not what they're thinking about.
Well, exactly.
I think it's just more interesting to me to see like, okay, what did you actually do with your money?
I'll put it this way: if you have a thesis that's contra to mine, and you have, I don't know, six figures invested into it, I'm way more liable to reconsider my own thesis. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah.
So I think the biggest or the most common manifestation of this little thing that we're talking about is, okay, where do you live? Do you own property? Like that's the most obvious manifestation of this position or this mindset, right? Like if I'm talking to somebody who's from Phoenix and I'm like, and they say, oh yeah, Phoenix real estate is going up, and they don't own any property in Phoenix, then I'm like, okay, well your opinion is basically worthless. You know what I mean?
Like, you mean insofar as them suggesting that Phoenix is a great place to buy?
Yeah.
Yeah.
If somebody's like, Phoenix is great, but I don't live there and I don't own any real estate there. then I'm going to be like, okay, well, it's not that it invalidates the thesis. I'm just saying I'm not going to listen. I'm not going to consider this particular conversation into my worldview. I'm not going to integrate it into my worldview, basically.
Yeah, funny enough, like we were the opposite of that is like I was my wife watches this channel of like this Chinese woman who does real estate or she talks a lot about like where to put your money,
sure,
in terms of like regions of the world, right? And so she's buying up a lot of like Malaysian properties.
Okay.
And I think that's interesting, and that actually made her more interested in the fact that this woman is actually doing it. And her husband, the woman's husband, just sort of like offhandedly said, like, "Oh yeah, I put basically all of my retirement into one stock, which is Berkshire."
Oh, okay,
right,
okay.
And I thought about that, and I was like, "That's that's probably the one stock where if someone told me they had everything in one stock, I'd be like." Okay, that makes sense. like that's not a horrible thing to do. There's plenty of people who do that.
Oh, dude, I have seen cars driving around in my neck of the woods, which is Santa Monica, Malibu area.
Wealthy area, yeah.
BRKB.
Yeah.
Or BRKA on the license plate, dude.
Yeah.
Like nice cars in nice neighborhoods.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, holy shit. These people probably have... $10, $20 million in
easy.
Berkshire,
yeah,
in Berkshire stock, yeah.
Oh, easy, yeah. I mean, if they show up to Omaha, like $10, $20 million is like small potatoes compared to some of the people who have been investing.
Yeah, it could be $100 million.
Yeah, easy. And it was the fact that this guy said just sort of like blurted it out. He was like, "Yeah, look, I'll just be upfront with what I do. I took my entire retirement." And I put it into Berkshire because I don't want to really think about it. And that got me thinking. I was like, you know what? I'm in the search for like investments that I can go into now without feeling worried about. Because I am worried about the quote AI bubble in the sense of like, I don't know whether you could claim as a fact whether there is a bubble or not. All I know is that the more they report on it, the more they talk about it. The more I think it is likely to trigger a large imbalance of buys and sells. Let's put it that way. And so, it's I don't feel particularly safe buying broad index. I don't feel particularly safe because it's just so weighted towards Mag 7. So
yeah,
I was probably like my third investment that I was like, yeah, I'm comfortable with this. So I really only have three investments outside of like fucking, bunker treasuries like and cash. Yeah.
Gold, Berkshire, and
Chinese stocks.
Chinese and KWEB.
That's it. That's all I got. Keep it simple, man. I've got other things, like small amounts of other things that because I have to clear all my trades. I never sold them. But it's like it's small positions, and I'll probably put that into a fourth bucket, which is like YOLO investments, a 5% sandbox or something,
Sure.
I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. You're talking to a guy with a bunch of his money in Bitcoin, so
that's crazy, dude.
No, it's not that crazy.
You think really? Would you say you have a majority of your wealth in Bitcoin, or
no, not
just
a material
portion?
Not a majority, but I'll just put it this way. I saw it go from 70,000 down to 15,000.
And you just wrote it.
And I just wrote it, and it came back up to 125,000.
I guess so.
And I'm just like, whatever. That's fine. I don't care.
Funny thing is, the more boring Bitcoin has become, it's become a little bit boring the last year.
The volatility has gone way down.
Way down, right? It's always hovering around 100-something and... There's action. It'll go plus 2.5 points or something in a day, but not in any one particular direction for very long. So it has become somewhat of a boring asset in a way, at least for the past year. Who knows what's going to happen?
For now.
It could do whatever the fuck, but I just don't know what to think of Bitcoin because, I think Peter Schiff, you know Peter Schiff, the gold guy?
I do.
He always shits on Bitcoin as having an intrinsic value of zero. And thus he's saying that it will inexorably go towards zero as time goes on. But okay. I don't agree. I think that actually the correct statement is that Bitcoin has no intrinsic. It's not that its intrinsic value is zero. It's that it has no intrinsic value. It's undefined, which is different than zero. So it could basically be anything, in my opinion.
Well, you know what the funny thing about Peter Schiff is his his kid, his son, is a major Bitcoin proponent and investor. Yeah. It's really funny. It's super funny because you're like, at least a couple of years ago, his kid used to have like little Twitter wars with
his own father.
Yeah, with him on Twitter or X. But yeah. Anyways, I mean, I don't know. I mean, this is all like kind of sideshow stuff. You know what I mean? Like, it doesn't really matter.
No, I think it matters just in the sense that what he's saying is something that a lot of people believe, but I don't think it's true. I don't think it's, you know what I mean? Like, I think there's a difference between saying like it has no intrinsic value versus saying its intrinsic value is zero.
Wait, what? What's the difference there?
Intrinsic value to me means that there's a way to derive like a value for this thing. And I'm saying there's no way to tether it to any particular value, whether it's 100,000 or zero. Like there's no way to say it's worth zero. It's as unreasonable to say it's worth zero as it is to say it's worth 100,000.
I mean, that's kind of the investment thesis, right? Like there is no actual quantifiable value to it. So it could go to the fucking moon.
Yeah.
That's part of the
closest I think it's ever come, like the best candidate for a theory, which is obviously not correct, was tying it to the mining costs, but it really is not tethered to mining costs at all, you know?
Well, I mean, once you get into the costs of mining and costs of infrastructure, you get all these people who are like attacking it from that angle too, right? And you're seeing this now with the AI spend, all the CapEx that's going on. People are like, this is giant waste of money. You know, there's like a number attached to the amount of money that we're like all these publicly traded companies and God knows how many privately funded or private companies there are in this space. Look, they're launching the same attacks against AI as they were against crypto or whatever other thing that just uses a bunch of energy in the world. And that's just how it's going. It's just how it is. If you do something in the world that costs or that requires a bunch of energy and it's making a lot of money for a lot of people, people are always going to come back and tell you it's not worth it. The environmental costs are way too high. The energy costs are way too high, blah, blah, blah. Like it's just, you know, I said this 2, 3, 4, 5 years ago. I was like, yeah, this is the same exact attack that they launched against X, Y, and Z. Now they're doing it here. Now they're doing it there. But, you know, the thing is, these attacks are actually, I think they're weakening. They're becoming more weak as time goes on because people are sort of understanding that, look, beyond the basics of what we need to survive, like everything costs energy. It takes lots of energy to do whatever the hell it is we're doing as like humans. You know what I mean? So
you're saying that you think that the AI bubble is nonsense, that this is all wise investment and will lead to healthy profits?
I don't know. I mean, is it wise? I have no idea. I mean, I have some investments in this area, but not, you know, it's not like a huge thing that I've bet on. But let me ask you this. All of the dark fiber malinvestment that happened in the 2000s era. How do you think all these fucking data centers are communicating with each other? It's because they laid a fuckload of dark fiber in the year in Y2K around 1998 to 2005 or so.
Yeah, but a lot of people lost a lot of money buying into that, into the dot-com bubble.
Yeah, well, you don't have to buy into it. I'm just saying,
that's
like,
my point. But that's what the bubble is, right? The bubble isn't like, oh, are we going to have to convert these data centers into like public housing or whatever? It's, no, I mean, people not. Only asking that. I mean, the only real interest anyone ever has in that question is like, should I pull my money or should I invest it? Because they're kind of like, people are kind of worried about whether they're going to, they're missing out where, you know, in an investment cycle where we're actually still early and NVIDIA is undervalued, versus whether, you know, actually the stocks are, you know, pumped to the tits and, you know, there's no reasonable way to keep these price levels up. And if you're a buyer now, you're a sucker because you're a bag holder.
Yeah. Well, I'll just say from my point of view, yes, it's definitely a bubble. And if you top blast all of this stuff, you're a fucking fool.
Yeah. There you go. I mean, and I think that's the main, I think that's the only real interest people have in it. I don't think, I think people are, you know, the stuff about the energy, the waste of the, you know, how wasteful it is and how environmentally unsound it is or whatever. It's like, yeah, you can make that argument or whatever, but you know, the real interest that people have is like, what to do with your money? That's really what people are trying to figure out. So,
yeah,
I agree with you. I think, but on the other hand, the problem is like, I can't stay uninvested, right? Like you can't just say, oh, there's a bubble, therefore I don't have any of my money invested.
Well, yeah,
that's not wise either. So
that is the dilemma.
That's the dilemma. That's why I like Chinese stocks, because like as a whole, like I think if you want to get in, quote, on the ground level of something, I think the Chinese stock market is at ground level. Still, even though it's up like big time over the year to date, I think it's up like 30%+.
Well, they deflated the real estate bubble, and
yeah,
now they got to, you know, they have to.
They got to pump some other asset.
They got to construct something else to absorb all that capital that's coming in, or that people are now looking to invest. And yeah, that's probably.
Yeah.
It's probably just going to be another, you know.
I mean, I'm getting bubble. This. It's. I think it's one of the big underreported stories of our time right now, is how the Chinese stock market is giving really good returns, but it's ignored because it's always been like a very volatile market, and you can get big runs followed by huge bursts, and it goes nowhere. It went nowhere for like 20 years, right? Like it's dog shit.
Yeah, well, I mean, there was a big run up in like the 2005 era, I think, if I remember correctly.
I don't think it went anywhere though, right? It completely
crashed. So people, a bunch of people bought in 2005, and then it crashed. Yeah, I mean,
it's perceived as an emerging market. I mean, well, in all of the professional money space, China is an emerging market.
I mean, it is. If you look at the per capita GDP, it's definitely an emerging market. But I mean, I don't know, man. Like, I think it all just depends on policy, right? Like, we're on a global level. I don't think we're at the point where, we're definitely not at the point where free markets or whatever is the overriding rule set. I think it's all about government policy, whether it's in the US or Europe or emerging markets or whatever,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. You mean in terms of directing like what national investment priorities are, where we want to guide foreign investment into, and
yeah.
Stargate and getting all the Arab money to build data centers in the US or wherever the fuck. And yeah. Yeah, no, I agree.
Yeah, it's all government policy driven. So
yeah, it is, and I think that's why I bought Chinese stocks was because the government policy statements coming out of China.
Yeah, they're telling you to buy the fucking stocks.
Buy the stock. We're serious about this. We're trying to attract foreign capital. We don't think of the stock market as dog shit like we used to, and now we want a proper stock market. And I thought, well, it's priced like dog shit, and so buy it. And I'm getting better than U.S. equity returns on it. I think it's a great way to get equity level type returns without exposure to U.S. equities, which is my main thing. And then for the piece where you do want to be invested in the U.S., Berkshire, $380 billion cash hoard.
By the way, Warren Buffett is retiring.
Yep. So it's a great buying opportunity because a lot of people are selling out.
How do you feel about that?
Great. I mean, it's, I think that there's like 27 people working at Berkshire Hathaway's head office in Omaha.
Right.
And the guy that they picked, Greg Abel, who ran their, I think their insurance, I'm sorry, he ran the energy services side of it for forever. He's been there forever. In a place like that, like succession has been baked in for a long time. In my opinion, I mean, everyone knows each other like it's like their fucking family over there.
Right. Well, the question is, has Warren Buffett actually been involved in any of this shit for the last 5 years? Like, that's the real question, right? Is he just a mascot? Is he just a mascot?
Know.
Like, maybe his entire company, i.e. Berkshire Hathaway, has just been run by his lieutenants for the last 5 years.
Could be.
Because, like, if you look at somebody who's just about to retire or who's, like, fucking 90 years old or whatever. By the way, Charlie Munger is dead.
Right.
Like, maybe he hasn't even been involved for the past 5 years.
Yeah, and if he...
Let's call it five years.
He's self-aware enough, I think, that he would start doing that.
Sure.
You know?
Sure. I have no doubt. Yeah, for sure.
Anyway, I mean, you're right. Like, the price has reflected the fact that Buffett is stepping down. And what, I mean, if you want to buy a discount, you got to understand like what the discount's for. And I'm like, Buffett stepping down is a great fucking opportunity to buy in because it's like, it's a question. Do you trust?
Yeah. Buy the dip.
Yeah. Do you buy this dip? Because, do you think.
Buy the Buffett dip.
Yeah. Is the post Buffett dip like a real factor in the pricing long term? Or is this just like, okay, a lot of people were like, dude, I ride with Buffett. If he's retiring, I'm going to sell my shares. It's not necessarily like based on anything bad, in terms of the succession.
Well, yeah, and by the way, Buffett and Munger were not boomers; they were silent generation. So, yep. I'm pretty sure. I mean, how fucking old is Buffett right now?
He's got to be like 95, I think. Maybe even older than that.
Yeah, I'm looking at Warren Buffett, age
95.
Exactly 95.
Yeah.
Okay. So he's not even a baby boomer.
He's above the boomers, yeah. His kids are like old boomers.
Yeah, his fucking kids are baby boomers. Yeah. So it's crazy, right?
Yeah.
So somebody like that is I don't know, man. Like 95 years old? He's probably, I think the last move that he made on his own might be the 2008 financial crisis when Goldman Sachs and AIG and all that.
It was, I think it was BNSF, no?
Oh, the railroad?
Yeah.
Yeah,
that was probably like the last major, major move that they did.
Sure. Sure.
I think that was Buffett. I mean, maybe was, not. Yeah. I mean, it could have not been. I agree that he was definitely the one who negotiated the Goldman thing and all that.
The point is, we don't know.
Yeah.
Who actually masterminded all these. Anyways, all I'm saying is, yeah, your investment is probably smart. Probably smart.
I think so. I mean, whatever it is, all I know is I can live with it and. It's a thing where And you probably know this pretty well. It's not easy to find investments that you like, that you're willing to buy and are excited to own long term. You know, like it's just not.
Well, especially on the regret, especially on the regret side of the table, right?
Mm-hmm.
You especially don't want to do something that you regret. So if you have an investment that you are willing to make today, and as long, I mean, this is, you know, this is basically the same mindset as don't do anything you just don't want to do anything that you'll regret later. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And with a, like a 50 or 60 or 75, whatever the hell Berkshire Hathaway has, you're definitely signing on to that kind of, track record. And I think you'll be fine. Especially since Berkshire Hathaway, I mean, most of it's an insurance business, man. And in case you haven't noticed, insurance is like an incredibly good business.
Yeah.
In the last few years. And, you know, and if it's not a good business, they just pull out. Like if it's fire insurance in California, or if it's like hurricane insurance in Florida, they'll just fucking pull out. They're just like, yeah, we're over this. We're done. Bye.
Yeah. And for them, it's mostly a fine, like that's their capital source, right? Like they're trying to make profit. They're not trying to make, I mean, they do make profits in insurance, but they're really using that float to finance.
Well, it's not just a capital base, but it's their monthly recurring revenue.
Yeah.
You know? So it's like, not only is it the thing that sustains them in terms of a capital base, in terms of, you know, all of the insane amount of equities that they, or excuse me, bonds that they own, that, like, dude, Berkshire Hathaway is like something like the number six or number seven owner of treasury bonds.
Yeah.
Both short term and long term. Like, so they have that, but also they have the monthly recurring revenue from their crazy insurance business, which is what, Geico or whatever the fuck it is.
And then, among others.
Yeah, among others. Among many others. So yeah, it's a great business, obviously.
I mean, I think of it kind of like the American version of like a Japanese, one of those like
Zaibatsu
conglomerate. Yeah, where I think in Japan, in the middle of this conglomerate is a bank. You know, like a MUFG or something, like, you know, like a bank in the middle. But you can't have a conglomerate that owns a bank in the US, otherwise you become a bank holding company. So the next best thing to that, outside of owning your own bank,
is an insurance company.
It's the same fucking thing.
Yeah.
It's a giant pool of money with
same goddamn thing.
With a bunch of liabilities attached to it, that, you know, contingent liabilities in this case. But yeah. Okay, deposit liabilities versus life insurance. I don't know, man. I'm turning this into a fucking finance pod. Only because finally get to the fucking point of this pod. Sorry for dragging out 28 minutes of fucking talking about dog shit stocks. Is that I don't know. I've become a lot more interested in investment just because, like, I think I'm just going to be managing investments more and working a hell of a lot less starting now, to be honest. I've already been working less because I got my eye on February where I'm,
good job.
I'm just out. Yeah, you
if
think
you're
so?
If you're at a position where you can even consider doing that, then I think, yeah, good job.
Well, thank you. I would say... I don't know if you agree with this or not, but I've never been like a really, you know, engaged investor. I pretty much like just do whatever the fuck, right?
Me too.
I would say that my personal experience, and this goes against a lot of like the current culture, which is a very like, it's a very YOLO, or it's a really like FOMO type culture where people are trying to take big swings and get big 100x. You know, that like the idea that you'll turn 10,000 into 100,000 and then into 1 million. And then, you know, like, I don't find that that helped me at all. I think what helped me really was, controlling spending. I find that the ability to like accumulate wealth, I think the biggest factor is controlling your spending. That's my going thesis.
Sure.
And my main contention for that is that reducing spending by $10 is roughly equivalent to earning $17, additional $17 because of the tax.
Well, yeah, I mean, just from the tax implications alone.
Correct.
I mean, you're halfway there, or yeah, more than halfway there.
So you, I think, like, in a way, it's best to keep in, like, every time you have a discretionary amount that you can choose to either spend or not spend, in my mind, I scale it up by the tax lever factor and say, oh, yeah, if it's $100 that I don't have to spend,
I mean, just double
it. It's really 170.
Just know? Double it.
Or just double it. Yeah, just double it in your mind. Whatever.
Just exactly. Double it.
And that helps me a lot because, one, things you realize things are actually a lot more expensive because we tend to think of our income on a gross basis. I don't know why we do that. I think it's just because your offer letter comes with that number on it. You know what I mean? Your real income is what actually hits your bank. Okay. Like just everything I mean, is just everything else is fake.
I mean, yeah. Well, it also depends heavily on your jurisdiction and your state and all that stuff. Right. So yeah. So that's kind of like the, how do you say it? Like the, not the lowest common denominator, but the highest common denominator, like the amount of money that you make, quote unquote, make, it just is highly dependent on where you live. But you probably know a lot of people in a lot of different states, and like that's just kind of how you compare things. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I don't know, man. I think I see this more and more, like online. I don't know if it's because the algo knows I'm interested in this or not, but I would say I hear it a lot in real life too. Like I talk to my own boss about this all the time. Like we have like a weekly catch up, and every time I talk to her, she's just like, first thing she doesn't give a shit about any of my projects, you know. First thing she asks is like, so February's coming up. Are you still on track to just like, you know, to just resign and quit? And by that, she actually means because like I'm leaving this project. I mean, for sure, because
the project's like, yep,
but her question is like, am I leaving like my permanent job? And I said, yeah. She's like, oh God, I'm almost there. She's like, my financial advisor though, she, you know, they tell me like maybe I need a few more years of saving before I can really do it, and then I'm out. You know, and she wants to go to the UK.
I mean, the first time I had this conversation with a boss of mine, or somebody who managed me at least, mm-hmm, was very early on when I was 20 years old.
Oh wow, okay.
I 21 or 22. First job out of college. I was working for a consulting company, and I was at a major telecom company. I was basically working for AT&T.
That was the client.
That was the client. And I was just there. I was like, fuck. And this was in LA.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, this fucking sucks.
Have been so depressing.
It was so bad. I mean, look, they were, I think I was making 150 grand a year at that point.
That's pretty good, dude. What year was this?
A long time ago. Like
that's a lot of money a long time ago.
2006, 2007, something.
Okay,
like
that's
that.
A good amount of money, dude.
Yeah, that was probably worth, I don't know, 200 grand these days.
Yeah.
Anyways, so
I think it's more than that, dude. I think it's like double.
Yeah, maybe a quarter mil. Maybe a quarter mil.
Yeah.
Anyways, but they had me working on the worst fucking possible projects. Okay. And then I was like, I just don't want to do this. And this was in Los Angeles. I'm in tech. I was like, I'm moving to San Francisco. And so I talked to the actual company I worked for, and also the you know, the client company. And I was just like, hey, you gotta like put me you gotta put me on something better. Like, I don't wanna do this like terrible fucking assignment. Because I was 22 years old, you know. They're like, oh, this kid, he's smart. This kid, we'll just put him on you know, the worst possible fucking job in the entire company, basically. Yeah. And so I just said, like, yeah, I'm moving to San Francisco. And I did. And all the people in the company that I was actually at, the end customer, the client, they tried to get me to stay so fucking hard. They were offering me all this stuff and like all these perks and all this, and I was like, no, I'm out of here.
Yeah.
You know, at the end of the day, like,
probably because like having you staff there was earning them good money for nothing.
Yeah, you know? Of course. Yeah. Because even at my inflated consulting rates that they were ultimately paying, like it was not, how do you say it? Yeah, the cost benefit was way in their favor. So anyway, so yeah, man, they never want you to quit, dude. Once you're hooked into the system and you're working, dude, they don't want you to quit.
Yeah.
They want you to stay there no matter what. And all of the people that you're, you know, whether it's the actual company you work for or if you're just a W-2 employee and it's your boss, like, dude, of course they want you to fucking stay. They're like, yeah, you're doing all this work and we're paying you not that much money. So please stay.
Well, we're paying enough for you to think it's a lot, but then you should see the kind of bills we're charging using you. You know what I mean?
Of course. Yeah. Of course.
So, I mean, even at the law firm, you should see what they bill me out at. And I'm like, yeah, that's not even close to what I make. You know what I mean? Like, the amount of money that they're working, that they're making off of like bodies in the professional services world is like astronomical compared to what they're actually paying you, even though the comp is pretty high, like on an absolute basis.
Oh, I would,
like,
yeah,
they're,
I mean,
making way fucking more than that, you know, off your back. So
yeah, back in the day at that job that I was just talking about, I was making $75 an hour.
Yeah.
Okay, and then they were billing me out at like $400 an hour.
Yeah.
This is in 2007.
Yeah.
So I was just like, oh, come on.
My first taste of this was when I was working for Princeton Review, if you know that company. They're big out here in the East. I don't know if they're out in the West.
Well, oh, definitely. I took Princeton Review courses to do SAT. to do SAT training.
SAT prep. I worked for them in college to make a few bucks. And I was pretty happy because they're paying me like $25 an hour. But these kids were paying $850 for the course, and I had like 15 kids.
Oh, I was that guy. I was that kid.
Yeah.
I was that kid for sure, man. Like, yeah. there was some guy. I was 16 years old.
Yeah.
And he was like 22, went to Yale, just graduated. Let me think about this. When was this? So I was a, this would have been 99. So yeah, I don't know if that actually has anything to do with the macroeconomic tides of that point in time, but so I was actually, no, this was like 98, 99. There was probably like a mini recession or something. Anyways, so yeah, so I went to the Princeton Review course to do the SAT prep for fucking SAT 2 subject tests.
Oh, I remember those. Yeah.
Math and English, and also just SAT, like the regular whatever test. And this kid had gone to Yale. He was probably like 20. I think I was 16. He was like 23, 24 year old Asian guy.
Yeah.
I think it was Korean. Anyways, he was like, yeah, I'm like here, just doing Princeton Review. And, I mean, dude, he got me into college probably.
Right.
But anyways, yeah, I know all about that.
Yeah, no, I mean, but I was like, dude, this company's making some serious coin off my fucking labor. You know what I mean? Like, I got to drag these like 15 kids through the SAT for like how many, you know, for 2 months or whatever. and I'm getting paid my $25 an hour, and they're getting, you know, they're getting what, well over 12, 13 grand off this little batch right here.
Oh yeah, definitely.
You know, I'm not making that much during these 2 months. Oh, so.
I think my parents paid at least $1,000 for like a couple weeks of like
couple weeks. Yeah, yeah, it was like super expensive.
Like a couple hours a week for like a few weeks.
Yeah, and I'm doing all the work. They literally just give me a book and push me into school and are like, do it. And I'm like, you know, I got to like unlock the fucking door and let these kids in and stuff and teach them for 2 hours.
Well, it's funny. One of my buddies, he actually went to UCLA and ended up going to work for Cisco after college. So he did fine in life. But when he was in school, he did private tutoring. For $150 an hour.
It's not bad.
For $150 an hour, without a corporate thing.
It's all his. He just keeps it all.
He just found his customers.
Yeah.
And he was like, dude, UCLA is in Westwood. All these fucking rich families in Westwood and all, you know, all these areas are like UCLA, by the way, for those who don't know. UCLA is like in the nicest fucking neighborhood in LA. Mm-hmm. It's not like USC in the middle of like a shitty part of town. It's in the middle of the West Side. It's in Westwood. It's in a neighborhood technically called Holmby Hills, Holmby. And these houses are like incredible. And a lot of these kids, they just want someone at UCLA to like just teach them fucking remedial math and English, and it's a crazy market out there.
Yeah, I know. I mean, a lot of people I knew, maybe not a lot, but I knew a few dudes who just like that was just their full time gig. Man, they just opened up test prep. Like that's been, like if you go through any like Asian enclave, there's just like test prep centers like fucking everywhere. Dude.
Oh yeah, for sure.
And they're probably cleaning up with that shit.
No, for sure.
I don't know. Boring as hell, though. Can you imagine that? That's what you did.
Money is money.
Money is money. That's true. Okay. No, you're right. You're right. In fact, I was just talking to a fairly distant relative, but who is sort of under our like collective family care here in New York because he's from New Zealand and he's here.
Wow. Okay.
Like all the, you know, for college, but all the way.
How exotic.
How exotic, yeah. And I was just talking to him earlier tonight because he was over at our uncle's place for dinner, and he's about to graduate, and he's trying to like figure out where to
work.
He's
like a 20-year-old or a 18-year-old kid.
21. No, he's like a senior. 21. He's a college senior. Kid. He's like graduating this year or this academic year. And I was like. He's having like, I mean, he's like a, you know, he's like at fucking Columbia and he's like an engineering guy and he was at a major tech firm over the summer and having, I wouldn't say a hard time, but like, you know, the interview process is harder this year than it has been. Obviously.
Yeah. Nobody's kissing his ass right now.
Nobody's kissing his ass. And, you know, the, you know, the place that he summered at, like, didn't come back with like an immediate offer. They were like, look, we're, you know, we've got, I mean, they've been laying people off.
Yeah. Right.
So, I mean, that doesn't mean that you're not going to get an offer, but it's probably harder for them to get headcount right now because they're right in the middle of fucking axing people. And, I was talking to him and I was like, you know, it's when like the step from college, that's when you truly get off of the kid train and you're in the adult world now.
For sure. You got to pay your own bills. You got to get a job, all that stuff.
Yeah. Because up until this point, like people were making, like they were, you were paying them. You were paying the school, you're, you know, whatever. Now they're paying you, but that kind of changes the fucking power dynamic. And I said, you know, probably for a few months, they'll try and give you the kid gloves thing where it's all about orientation, you know, as if you were going to like school again. And then They'll play nice with you for a little bit, but then pretty soon the gloves come off. And
well, yes.
And then suddenly you're like, you're in it. You're in the real world.
So here's the funny thing about this, right? Like after when I grad, so the era that I graduated in, which was, I graduated 05. Okay. So right before the GFC and things are fucking slamming, right? Like going really good.
Yeah.
Everyone's making a ton of money. The interesting thing was in the finance world.
I'm sorry. You said pre or post GFC?
Pre-GFC.
Oh, pre-GFC. Okay, yeah.
Oh, I graduated in 05.
Okay, yep.
So the interesting thing was the more financially oriented jobs that people got, like in finance and banking and accounting and whatever, there were these like training programs.
Mm-hmm.
Like the first year, like not necessarily a year, but like 6 months to 9 months of your job was basically just getting trained.
Yeah.
In like these little like feeder training programs in these firms.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was, I didn't know what that was because in the tech world that didn't exist at that time. Maybe it does today. I don't know.
I bet it does now, but yeah.
Mm-hmm. Maybe. But like when I graduated, it was just like, do you know what you're doing or don't you?
Deep end of the pool.
And then just fucking throw you onto a team. Mm. And I remember the first week I was, not the first week, maybe the first month that I got placed in my first consulting position because I went to work for a consulting firm, which ended up getting bought by Microsoft. And so I ended up at Microsoft for a while. But anyway, so the first month, they just stuck me in a fucking, we used to call it a war room, which was just like, okay, we have this site or thing that we're operating. And there's problems, like we're having problems with this thing. We're going to stick you into a war room with like six other guys and you better fucking figure it out.
Mm.
That was it. Mm-hmm. You know, like I'm sure in finance there's the equivalent thing, but only after you've gone through like the training program. Like they're not going to take you out of undergrad, like a month out of undergrad, and just like stick you into a room with like a bunch of guys who are doing things.
Yeah.
Who are like 10 years older than you, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so that used to be a thing. I don't know if that's a thing anymore. Like it might be more structured now. Because remember, this was 20 years ago. This was 05, 06.
Yeah, I have no idea how the incoming classes at tech firms work, but I presume there is some level, but not much. But like, yeah, I don't know what it's like at banks either, because I've never worked in that capacity at a bank, like as, you know, right, an analyst sort of route.
Right. You weren't the investment banking guy.
No. I mean, I was in law, right? So,
yeah.
But yeah, I mean, regardless of like, you know what company I did work for after college was MicroStrategy before it became a Bitcoin company. And it was a high flyer. Actually, they were the first company to really, they were the pin that pricked the bubble back then.
Yeah, blew up.
Yeah, MicroStrategy and their for people that don't remember or weren't around for this, but Michael Saylor was famous a long time ago as the guy who lost more money in one day than any man in history. $6 billion of wealth he raised in one day because of accounting fraud. With the same company as is being used as a Bitcoin holding company now, which is MicroStrategy. But they did have a training program because they were like a database. Inside of that shitty meme stock is a real company.
They're a BI company.
Yeah, they're a business intelligence company, and they had a real product, and it was actually considered a pretty good product. It was a premium product. And they ran a relational database boot camp to get you to build like a relational database model or whatever. It was fantastic. Oh my God. It was such good training.
Really?
Oh, it was incredible. Okay. Yeah. I learned way more in that than any like single sort of hands-on type class in college. It was amazing training. I never used it because the company went to shit immediately after that. But even in these stonky companies, there is a real company underneath that does real work.
Well, of course. Yeah. I mean, look, if they actually sell software to clients that actually pay the money, there is something work. There. Yeah, there is something there. Yeah, for sure.
But yeah, I mean, but point being, like, there is a training period. And in that period, you get this sense of like, ah, this is cool. Like, we're going to ease into this and we're going to learn and it'll be fun. But then the second you got dropped out of that, like, that was done and you got assigned, then it became like a hazing ritual. You know, and then you were the dumbest guy in the room. You're the one that had to go get coffee or whatever. And you just became the bitch. And at that point, I guess what I'm trying to say is that I don't know how other people feel, but I feel like you do get a rough introduction to the working world.
Oh, for
and,
sure.
And then that does shit to you. I think, like, looking back on that introduction into the quote real world and the working world and stuff, it's like that feeling never left me of like, this is like a, it's kind of like a wilderness. This is not a good environment. This is an environment that you need to protect yourself against and work within. Like, you need to be opportunistic and work within it, but it's not here to nurture you.
No, it's a deep end for sure.
It's the deep end, dude. And you get you could get fucked up if you're not, serious about your own interests and how you're going to protect yourself and navigate this world. Whereas before, you could rely on the institutions to take care of you, and they're not going to do that.
No. Yeah. I think the ground floor into the enterprise is probably still a little bit, I mean, it's basically like grad school light. You know what I mean? Like, they'll kind of help you along a little bit, but at some at some point you're just on your own for sure.
You're on your own,
and it's crazy because I remember back in my time when I started working at, you know, basically Fortune 500 companies, like, I was dropped into the middle of like fucking AT&T and Microsoft and all these like all these crazy huge companies, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, all the people that I would
do very serious work. I mean,
they do very fucking serious work. Yeah. And so I remember, just like in the morning I would show up, I would have already eaten my fucking, bagel and coffee or whatever. And then I would just be dropped into these intense situations. And then, to their credit, all of these guys that I would work with, we would go to lunch and they would be super fucking cool. Like the corporate veil just like kind of dropped.
Oh, okay.
You know?
Yeah.
And it would be super cool at lunch. And then as soon as we got back to the office, it was just like back to fucking work.
Right.
Like,
yep.
Like don't even remember that we just had lunch.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so that was like that's how it was back in 05, 06.
Yeah.
Around there.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that it was this sort of like, I reckon it's a little bit,
And that's like part of the training, right? It's like, we'll get drinks or lunch or whatever, but yo, in the office, like, watch your fucking ass.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. No, totally. I think it's a little bit like, I reckon it's a little bit like being in a corporate workforce is like not that different in terms of social structure than being in like a military force. Like, the chain of command chart is the fucking
chart. It's not a fucking democracy.
It ain't no democracy. That's exactly like, you know, chuck all your, I felt like, I did notice, you know, there were people who had a rougher time, adjusting to this. And, I, for example, I just never really internalized it. I always felt,
no way.
I was like, there's something fucking weird about this. And then it just became this thing where I was like, but you got to do it. And then slowly it dawned on me. I'm like, oh, right. I don't have money. This is why I'm relegated to this shit.
No,
because
shit.
I see other people. I knew people with a lot of money and they didn't have to do this shit.
Well, you know what? What's really funny is, so I kind of came in through the back door, right? Like, I was in this consulting clique that just had inroads to all these companies. And then some of the people that I was working with were Accenture consultants and like KPMG consultants, at AT&T and Microsoft. And dude, they were like, they like couldn't even talk to me. It was crazy. And they're of my same age. Mm-hmm. So I remember there was a, you know,
because they were socially retarded. Is that what you're trying to say?
No. It's because they worked for these consulting companies, like these brand name consulting companies. Mm. But I didn't. Okay. I worked for a smaller consulting company.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But I could just walk into these places, and because I worked for a smaller software company.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah.
So I would walk in with t-shirt and jeans on, and they were like in their fucking consulting get-ups.
Yeah.
And I would try to talk to them, and they would just be like very, very stiff.
Because they were going through their officer corps training program.
Exactly. They were going through yep. their, like, you know, Accenture or KPMG or whatever the fuck company back then was.
Yeah. PwC, all the
big four
consulting.
Like,
yeah.
Yeah. This is big corporate America, right?
Yeah.
And so I would try to. I'm pretty sure this is pre Enron.
Yeah.
Pre Lupi. Anyway, so I would like try to talk to these people, and they just couldn't really talk to me. You know what I mean? Like, I couldn't connect to them on like a human level. And I was like, that's weird. And you know, I was too young to really understand it, but at the same time, I kind of did.
Right.
It's like, oh, they're like working for some weird corporate overlord or whatever. So they, like, I remember I used to go out. So this was in downtown Pasadena at the AT&T office, which is like right next to the all sorts of corporate shit in Pasadena. So I used to go out and for lunch, there was an Italian place called Il Fornaio, mm-hmm. which is now it's like some shitty PE owned chain or whatever. But back in the day, it was like a really nice Italian restaurant. So I used to go in there every day and like, you know, order some food and then like go out into the little courtyard and like smoke a cigarette.
On the company dime.
Of course, on the company dime. Well, my per diem, dude.
Mm-hmm.
It was like a fucking.
It's a gilded cage.
Yeah, for sure, man. Yeah. It was like a $75 per diem in like.
Oh yeah, 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 yeah. The money was flowing. The money was flowing.
It was crazy.
The money was flowing.
I was just like eating free food left and fucking right, and then people would fly in from out of town and like take us to these crazy sushi dinners and stuff. Mm-hmm. I was like, oh, this is awesome.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I used to go like, but you know, on a random Tuesday or whatever, I used to go out and get some Il Fornaio and then sit in the courtyard and like smoke my cigarette and try to talk to these people, and they were so fucking uptight. I was like, oh my god.
Yeah.
You guys are fucking crazy. Sometimes I wonder what happened to those people, because.
Yeah, I don't know, man.
They were my age, but they just like couldn't fucking. I mean, look, they were friendly and all, but
no, I know they were in hazing mode. Is my view of that? You know, and I remember back then, like getting a job with PwC or Anderson was like a big deal. And it was like, that was, you know, people gave you a lot of props for landing a job with a big four, and then it was consulting, and then it would be like internet, it would be adjacent to like internet companies. And
nobody
really had a true understanding. Like most people didn't really know how people made big bucks. They didn't really understand. They just wanted to be like near where the action was. And
right. Like, what's going on here? Like, oh, this looks good. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so it would attract people who weren't really players, but they were just sort of in the background. They were NPCs.
Definitely NPCs.
Like, these people are NPCs, but they're just happy to be in the game. You know what I mean? Like, in the game in the sense of, like, literally there's, like, a data structure representing you somewhere in the game. And
some spreadsheet somewhere.
Some spreadsheet somewhere you're accounted for, but just barely.
Yeah.
And
that's crazy, dude.
Yeah, it is crazy. It is crazy that how much, like, action attracts people. Like I think like an Andrew Yang is the product of that. Like he was like a couple classes ahead of me at Columbia.
Oh god.
And then he probably came out 2002, like just post the .com bubble crash or whatever. And but you know, tech picked up pretty quickly after that crash, right? Like tech didn't really.
The money flowed in immediately. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of the excesses got, you know, you had to go through like a forest fire period, and then but then it was right back to the fucking game. I barely missed a beat. And Andrew Yang, in my opinion, was the type of guy who was like East Coast product, you know, went to like Cornell, not Stanford or Berkeley or something like that. So didn't have like that path into
Andrew startup. Yang is such a fucking mystery to me as a West Coast guy. Like, I'm just like, what the
fuck? Well, he's an East Coast guy.
Exactly.
Who longed to be a West Coast guy. So he went out to the West Coast and then did some dog shit this or that.
Yeah,
and never really accomplished much, but then, you know, came back to the East and claimed to have to be a tech guy. Because he's Asian, everyone bought it and was like, yo, it's an Asian tech founder.
He's from
Cupertino. He was like, I'm running for president.
What? Like, what?
So bizarre. But yeah, I think there was, I mean, he was very legible to me because I think there were a lot of East Coast Asians who were like, yo, the action's all on the West Coast. We're going to go out there and whatever. Yeah. And, you know.
Well, I'm younger, but also, yeah, he's just totally opaque to me. I'm just like, what the hell is this guy? Who is this guy? Like, I've never met a guy like this in my fucking life. Like, what?
I know such guys all too well.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, hold on. I'm going to use a.
Oh, so should we transition over to the bonus pod then? We'll call it here and then when
sure, yeah, 1 hour, yeah, perfect.
Break and then. All right. Perfect. So, why don't you go do your thing and then I'll outro us and then you know, if you want to we'll continue this discussion on the bonus pod as usual. If you want access to bonus pods, go to patreon.com/planningmech.